From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. Today, I have the privilege of welcoming Jeanette Lefkowitz, a towering figure in competitive skydiving in the United States. Jeanette's influence spans widely. It's a common thread among many four-way teams to find at least one member who has benefited from her coaching or mentorship. As the co-founder of SDC Rhythm XP, she has been at the helm of a team that embodies excellence since its inception in 2007, consistently competing at the highest levels globally. In addition to her competitive achievements, Jeanette co-founded the Women's Skydiving Network, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting and increasing female participation in skydiving. Above all, Jeanette serves as an exemplary ambassador for the sport. Her contributions are marked by undeniable class and unwavering professionalism, making her a respected and influential figure in the skydiving community. Welcome to the 20-Minute Call, Jeanette Lefkowitz.
Oh, man, you're making me blush.
That's quite a resume.
Yeah, well, it's just very sweet. That's very nice things to say. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thank you for all you've done for our sport. Jeanette, let's begin from early days.
Sure.
Your hometown is in the hotbed of Florida skydiving.
Yes.
You are from Sebastian?
Actually, I'm from New Smyrna Beach.
New Smyrna Beach.
Area. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, which is very near the land.
Yeah. So were you even aware of skydiving growing up?
No. Growing up, I was a nerd, really. You know, I wanted to be an astronaut, and I was very focused on, like, I would get a goal, and especially if someone told me I couldn't do it, then that's exactly what I wanted to do. So yeah, I mean, there was skydiving going on, but I was not aware of it. You know, I think the first time I became aware of skydiving was, so I went to MIT, and there they had a skydiving club, but I wasn't interested in at all. I was just like, well, I don't have time for that. I'm doing, you know, got my own stuff that I'm doing. So, it wasn't really until I got out of school, got a job. My uncle was skydiving, and then I was kind of aware of it, and then started thinking like, oh, it's something I'll do just once, like everybody, like a lot of people do, you know.
So what were you like? You said you were pretty, quote unquote, nerdy as a kid. Did you have siblings? And I imagine you were a brilliant student.
Yeah. So I have two sisters. They're half sisters. One is 6 years younger than me, and one is 11 years younger than me. And they're awesome. And yeah, I was very much into my studies. I swam, and I was on, I played the piano, and I was on the academic team. For me, it was though a lot about building up my my application for colleges, you know, and I wanted to go, and I really wanted to be an astronaut. And so I had a book that had on the back of it, it had like a glossary of, it had colleges and which astronauts went to each college. And so from there, you could see which school had the most astronauts from it. And I remember there was, the military academies had the most, but my eyesight wasn't good. And I was like, I don't know if I really want to go in the military because I don't have a lot of control over, you know, I don't have full control over what I want to do, you know? So the first kind of non-military school that had the most astronauts was MIT. So that's it. And I was like, well, that's where I'm going. So that was in middle school. And then I was pretty much focused on that, you know, and then for sure, during high school, a few people told me not to go to MIT, which is just what I needed to make me want to do it. So, so yeah, so that's that. As a student, I also was very, everything was black and white for me. You know, I definitely believed you either, you know, it was either one way or another, and that was it. You know, those are things I feel like I've grown as a person to understand that there's a lot of gray.
Being that you have achieved at the highest competitive aspects of the sport,
yeah,
were you a very good athlete?
Not really. So I was on the swim team, and really I was there. I knew that being in shape was good, and I knew that being that having a well-rounded resume was good for college. And so I kind of did, my friend and I, Stephanie, were on the swim team, and we would do just well enough that the coach wouldn't yell at us. It was about what we did. And we were good at figuring that out. And so I was good. I would, when we would enter us in a competition, there would always be, and in Florida, swimming is very competitive. Our school would have three people. Their school would have three people. Our top woman was supposed to beat their top woman. Our second woman was supposed to beat their second woman. So I was always our second woman, and I knew my job was to beat their second woman. So I would do that. And then, but I wasn't going to try any harder than that. You know, like it was just, I was young. And so I wouldn't say I was a, I just didn't think of myself as an athlete at that point. I thought of myself as trying to build my resume. I was very competitive when it came to academics or that kind of stuff, you know. As far as any kind of athletic stuff, not at all, I would say, yeah.
When I hear the words MIT,
yeah,
I feel intimidated because I would have a 100% chance of never getting into that school. I simply am not intelligent enough to gain entry. So I have admiration for anyone who goes there. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be there and be surrounded by so many smart people?
It was interesting. Like it definitely... So in high school, I grew up in this small beach town where people go on vacation, you know. Now I'm actually moving back here and I love it and it's wonderful. But as a kid, you're like, man, I can't wait to get out of here. And I just wanted to go to me, MIT seemed like this excellent school and everyone was so smart and they're working hard. And high school was academically quite easy for me. So I wanted to go somewhere that was challenging. When I got to MIT, I had to study and I didn't know how to do that. I didn't expect to be the brightest at MIT, but it was hard. It was hard at first. And I remember it was hard. I don't remember this, but my mom remembers me calling her and saying, you know, I didn't expect to be the smartest person at MIT, but I also didn't expect to be the dumbest person here. And in my moment of, you know, freshman, like, oh, what was me? You know, it was great. Like, it was tough. And MIT does this amazing thing. A lot of schools will flunk out. They're freshmen and their classes get smaller. At least when I was there, and I think this is still the case, MIT has this this attitude of, look, it was hard to get in. And once you're here, we want to get everybody up to speed. And we understand that people are coming from lots of different backgrounds. So the entire first semester was pass, no record. So you either pass the class or it was like you didn't even take it. And then the second semester, I think, was pass, fail. And I feel like that really took a lot of pressure off of us, you know, of just... And so it was still tough, but I got to really, it gave me time to kind of relax a bit and realize like, man, what an amazing place I'm at, you know? Everybody takes the same things and it's very science focused at first. I remember my physics class, my recitation instructor. So there was like 10 of us, you know, with an instructor kind of going over basic physics stuff, was Alan Guth, who's like, an expert on the expansionary theory of the universe, like just these amazing, you just get exposed to such amazing people. So it was both. It was both like, wow, like drinking from a fire hose is a common phrase you hear about MIT. And it was very much that, but it was also like, man, what an amazing place I'm at, you know, for me. I mean, it made me realize that I can do whatever I want to do for sure. Graduating from there, I met Steve, which changed my life, you know, so there's, it was great. It was great. I don't know if I would get in now. I'll tell you that. And sometimes I think Steve and I joke that like, we talk about like engineering a dive and we think like someone from MIT is going to come and be like, hold on, what are you calling engineering? We're taking your degree away. But yeah, it was wonderful. And I am so fortunate I got to go and I thought it was great.
And you got your degree in mechanical engineering while there. And was that the degree that you determined was the best way to become an astronaut?
Yeah. So by that point, I forget when I decided, like by the time I went to MIT, I don't think I actually was like, okay, I'm going to be an astronaut. When I went there, I was thinking I wanted to do biomedical engineering. And then as I got there, I'm like, man, I don't know if I really want to like go the medical route. I know that's a lot of schooling. So it's like mechanical engineering is really cool. I get to like work with things and learn stuff. But I didn't really, at that point, I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. I decided I was going to MIT because I wanted to be an astronaut. But by the time I got there, that was not, I mean, of course it would have been cool, but I wasn't like, that's what I feel like I'm going to do at that point. Yeah.
You mentioned you met Steve, your husband.
Yeah.
Many people listening to this know Steve.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people would like to know, what was Steve Lefkowitz like at MIT when you met him?
He was great. It's interesting. Like, I always remember him being very, very studious. And of course, everybody at MIT is, but whereas I was okay with being a B student at MIT, I was like, this is great. I feel very accomplished. He had to get an A, you know. One class that we had, we were both in the same class together, but we hadn't met yet, was organic chemistry. And I was very proud that I got an A in this class, because it was a tough class and there's a lot of people. And when I met him, we were talking about it and I was telling him, he's like, oh yeah, I got an A+ in that class. That was very Steve. He worked very hard. We were both, I was in a sorority and he was in a fraternity at MIT, which surprises a lot of people because it's not, if I'd gone to any other college, I'm sure I wouldn't have been in a sorority. But he was very involved in his fraternity. He was the rush chair and yeah, he worked very hard in that too. Yeah, I just remember him working really hard. He had this job, he was a chemical engineer, and he had this job for TurboChef onion ovens, which are in all the subways and stuff. And in order to do the job, he had to cook food. And then there's this food just left over. So he was just in the sub-basement of Building 66 at MIT. Like, there's no signal, anything. He's just in there cooking and eating food. It was like the perfect job for him. I remember that about him as I met him. So.
How soon after meeting did you all get married?
So we met in junior year, and then we got married in 2005. So we met in 98. And we got married in 2005. So it was a while. We actually, when we left school, we broke up. We were like, we're going to see other people. We were both I was going to Chicago. He was kind of moving around. We were just like, oh, maybe it doesn't make sense. So we had a period of time where we were like, you know, figuring it out, and very quickly realized there's nobody else that that fits each other as well.
I can't imagine a Jeanette without a Steve and a Steve without a Jeanette.
Me either. But I was young. He was young.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble. Burble. So somewhere in this process, you're introduced to skydiving from, I believe, your Uncle Hal.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I graduated MIT. I was working, so I had money, you know, and not a lot, but I had enough money to go skydiving. And I was home for Thanksgiving, and I was talking to Hal, and I knew he skydived, and he was just starting to get back into it. He had done a few jumps when he was younger, and now he's getting back into it more actively. And we were talking at Thanksgiving, and I was like, yeah, I'd like to go. And he's like, well, you could do a tandem, but you know, you're just going to want to do it, so you should just do AFF. I'm like, nah. So I went with him, and I did a tandem that Thanksgiving, and he was right. As soon as I did a tandem, I'm like, okay, now I got to get my license. But I was living in Chicago at the time, so I was like, there's no way I can start getting my license in November. It's cold. So I made a plan to wait until the spring, and then I would start then. And then that was it. And then Steve and I were kind of dating off and on. And so he was like, okay, I'll do that first jump with you. Cause I was just like, you know, like anybody, you do your first jump and you're like, this is all I want to do. I want to talk about this. And he was like, all right, I'll do that with you. And he at the time was like, well, I can't just do a tandem because then I'll be one jump behind Jeanette. Like, I got to do an AFF. So he did that first AFF with me in DeLand. We both went through the course and we both did a jump. And then he was like, I don't really want to do that anymore. I don't need, you know, I'm good. He felt like he didn't do very well, which is interesting, you know, now being in the sport more and being an instructor, like, oh, that was a missed opportunity for sure. But he just did that one jump. And then I was like, I'm continuing to do this. And so that whole summer I went and I got my license. It took me all summer to do it. And yeah, it just from there was hooked.
One thing that I found interesting in the interviews that I've heard together with both you and Steve, it was as if you would say, hey, Steve, you should, you know, maybe you should learn to skydive. Oh, I'm not really into it. And while you're learning, he's in the hangar. Like he still wants to hang out with you, but he's fine letting you do your thing.
Yeah.
Eventually he sees a light.
And like, oh, I wish I would have listened to Jeanette so much, so much way before. Yeah. And then the same with Tunnel Camps. And and then in 2007, you guys start the team. Mm-hmm. And 2009, you all quit your jobs. I know you were laid off and then he eventually quit. When I hear you say, you know, I was living in the black and white. Mm-hmm. You didn't say the word safe, but I was, you know, kind of following the narrow path. Mm-hmm. And then what I hear is a change sort of that says, hey, we should go all in on this skydiving thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not the traditional path.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're sort of bringing Steve along. I've heard Steve say, I would never have gotten into all this if it wasn't for Jeanette sort of pulling me along. Yeah. And then to leave the comfort of, you know, you're an, and also be under the, I imagine the pressure of the stereotype that when you go to MIT, mm-hmm. that means you're on a successful path for engineering and, you know, whatever occupation. Mm-hmm. And yet all of a sudden there's this boldness of let's cut away and let's go do this thing. And I'm hearing risk that seemed unfamiliar, or at least in your narrative, doesn't quite make sense. So why were you comfortable suddenly with all this risk to move forward in an untraditional path?
I get that for sure. I think that Steve and I are both very methodical, thoughtful people. So at that point, we had talked a lot about leaving our jobs. In fact, before we got into skydiving, we were thinking about taking a year sabbatical and buying a sailboat and sailing around the Caribbean. This was our goal. So we were already kind of toying with the idea of saying goodbye to the jobs for a bit, but we could always come back. I really like, there's something I saw or read about the idea of thinking about a choice as either a two-way door or a one-way door. And when you make a decision, if it's a two-way door, that means you could always go back, you know, and that you should be open to making those decisions because you can go back. And that's a big difference than a one-way door where once you go through that door, there's no going back. Having a kid, life and death stuff, you know, often marriage, divorce, those kinds of things those are one-way doors. So you should be really careful about that. And so when I think about actually our decision to quit my job, I know Steve and I, at that point, we felt like, well, maybe we couldn't get back to that company exactly at that position. That was the one-wayness of it. But like, I had an MIT degree. I had experience. Like, I could go back to work if I needed to. So while it's, you know, on paper seems risky to just cut away and go skydive, it was very much a two-way door for me because I knew, and that's what that MIT made me feel like, I could do whatever I wanted. And I definitely could go back and get a good paying job if I needed to, you know? And then on the other side, it wasn't like, you know, we had also been building up our coaching business at that point. We'd already done some tunnel camps. We were already kind of thinking about, okay, if we were going to, when we first quit, we thought just like we thought about with sailing, well, we can afford to take a year. And if we have to live totally off our savings for a year and we have to get a job in a year, like we can do that. And this is how we do it. So at the point at which we actually left our jobs, when I got laid off and then he left a couple months later, we'd already kind of had a plan both for how we were going to make money skydiving. And if we didn't, we felt very confident we could go back. You know, in fact, probably our companies would have hired us back. Well, we actually both worked at the same place. Steve went back to work for a little bit after he left as well. So I agree with you. And when you say it that way, it sounds risky, but to us it didn't, because we had a plan at that point.
What's interesting, though, is the plan that you created.
Yeah.
At least the plan A.
Yeah.
Was to be professional skydivers. The plan materialized maybe better than what you originally planned in terms of the coaching business.
Yeah.
But I'm not aware of anyone that's done it like you and Steve have done it.
Sure.
If you're going to be a professional skydiver, there's the normal track, become an instructor, work at the drop zone, pack, become a tandem instructor, work your way into management or ownership, et cetera. But were you able to plot the course, being that there was really no prerequisite?
Well, for sure, Airspeed was doing a ton of tunnel camps, and they were a huge inspiration to us. We knew Kirk Verner. Cromie was a big influence to begin at the beginning. So there was that. But then we also realized, like, I feel very much like if you can lean into the things you're good at, you can, that's where you can really thrive. And we felt like, okay, I might not, when we first left, we're like, we're not necessarily the most experienced skydivers. We don't have experience as instructors or as DZOs, but I can be really professional. We were both, even though we had engineering degrees, we were both working in business consulting, you know, so I can be as professional as anyone here, and I can run the most professional, most efficient camp I can. And so that's where we kind of started. We're like, well, let's do that, you know? And that's where this is like, this is how we're going to do it. And I did get my AFF rating, and Steve got his AFF rating and his tandem rating kind of as a backup. Like this is, we've seen people do this, but neither of us really used it that much. And we ended up giving him up.
Whoever did AFF with you guys.
it was very few. Like it was only a few days that SDC would need me. And then often like somebody that was having trouble or something, they'd be like, oh, you're an AFF instructor, I'll come with you. And I'd be like, yeah, I guess I am. I've only done a few, but I felt very comfortable. You know, I knew I could do what I needed to do, but yeah.
Amazing. One thing that really struck me was, you know, Rhythm starts in 2007. And as an intermediate team, you had just a little over a 10 average. Mm-hmm. And then by 2009, you're in open class. Mm-hmm. Like what went on between that period of time? Because I even think maybe you started in intermediate, but I think you competed in 07 and advanced.
That's
by
right.
The time you got to nationals.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That is a rapid time for a team to go from, hey, we're just a startup doing, you know, 10 point average to showing up at the nationals open class. And for those listening, unfamiliar with competition skydiving, open class is the pro league. I mean, that is the U.S. Army Golden Knights. It's Arizona Airspeed. It's the top of the top of the top of the game.
Yeah.
So how were you all able to bridge the gap from 07 to 09 in open class?
When we started Rhythm, it was Steve and I. So we were both on the team and we were both working in consulting. So there was nothing holding us back with time or money, you know, all of our money and all of our time. Great. Here you go, skydiving. And we met Laurent, who was a single guy, also in consulting. So also in a similar boat. So the three of us were very lucky to have each other in that there was just nothing holding the three of us back. So we got a player coach that year was Robert Cromie. Awesome. I just have so much fond memories of Cromie. And then we were just like, let's do everything we can. And it's funny now when I think back about it, like we only had one rig each. So we're like, okay, well, we'll just get unload one and then three and then five from sunrise to sunset every day that we can. And then that's it. You know, now it's crazy. I would tell a team that's doing that, like, don't do that, you know, but that's what we did. And we would go to the tunnel and we would do 2 hours a day of training at the tunnel. We were just young and like, we wanted to do as much as we possibly could. And there was nothing holding us back from doing it. So I think that first year we maybe did 500 jumps and 25 hours a tunnel or so. So, I mean, that's how we got from the 10 to the, and then that first year we did compete in advanced, that we were a guest team, because Laurent was still getting his green card. So we came in, we placed what would have been third, but we didn't get a medal. So then our next year was like, okay, our goal, Laurent's got his green card. So now we're going to win advanced with the highest average anybody's ever done. That was our goal. So then it was like, all right, well, we already know how we've done this before. So then it was just, and that's what we did the next year for, 2008. And then once you went advanced, you have to move up to open. And you're just like, yeah, that's what we're doing. And when there was no limits on what we, you know, on our time or we just put all our money and time into it, it was just very easy to be like, okay, this is what we're doing. We're going to do all this.
There's something to be said too for professionalism. Mm-hmm. Because I think so many people are actively looking for sponsorship. Mm-hmm. And you all got sponsorship by way of jumps, if I'm not mistaken, very early. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when I look at that, I go, well, your level of professionalism, how you all communicated, you were working for your sponsorship, not looking for something for free. And I often will say to people that are looking, you know, gosh, it's so hard to get sponsorship. I'm like, well, it is, but it's very easy to stand out if you do the right things. And I feel and Steve embodied that. Did you all have active conversations of this is how we're going to represent ourselves when we're at these places?
Yes and no. I mean, I think coming from a business background, we understood that like if somebody's going to give their parts of their business to you, it ultimately needs to make sense. Of course, there's generosity and you know, Rook Nelson has been incredibly generous to the team. But ultimately, if we're not helping his business, it's a business, you know, and I don't want him to, I mean, of course, yeah, I don't want him to feel like he's only giving and then we're not giving back. So I feel like we definitely talked about it as kind of our team mission and thoughts, but it was very much at the core of us. And when I think about that, about being professional and being business people, that's what we decided. And even in moving to Scott of Chicago to a bigger drop zone, we realized like, man, it's so much easier to bring value to a big drop zone, you know, and that's just how it is. And it's easy, you know, just, we want to be in a relationship where both people feel like, of course I got to do this. And that's how we've always been with our sponsors, you know?
Do you recall sitting in front of Rook and saying, sort of pitching him for full sponsorship?
Yeah. So I remember how it went actually. So we were at CSC a couple years, and then we realized we needed to train year round if we were going to get any better. So we were looking at different options, and we had been starting to build up the business, and we'd been calling a lot of people, and it was tough. And we'd get a lot of answers of like, oh, that's great. I'd love to be at one of your camps. When you come to Scott of Chicago and do a camp, let me know, because I jump there all the time, you know? And I was like, ah, but yeah, come on over here, you know? So I felt like it was a bit tricky, you know, but we worked really hard. And so that winter, as we were kind of planning and like, we're going to need to be able to train year round, Steve and I were working at the same place. So my office was right next to his. And I got an email from Rook, and it just said, are you guys ready to train year round yet? And I was like, yes, actually, that's exactly what I'm thinking about. And so I remember I called Steve up on my phone. We were already kind of thinking about leaving. So it was kind of like, Steve, I got, you got to come look at this email real quick. And so he walked over from his office and I'm like, look at this email from Rook. And so I emailed him back and I'm like, yes, absolutely. And we set up a meeting and we went out to talk to him. So he was already kind of thinking about this, you know, and so it was just, we were just like, yeah, this makes sense. And we talked to Doug, who was also incredibly supportive and so, yeah, I just grateful for everything he's done for the team leading up to that as well.
Doug from Chicagoland Skydiving Center. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that's where we were before we went to SDC. And we also talked to John Hart down at Start Skydiving. And, but ultimately we just knew that again, going back to that idea of going where you feel like you can do the most and, you know, it just makes the most sense. And that's kind of how it started with Rook. And yeah, it's been great. He's awesome.
I've always been impressed by Rook in that during our conversation and having sat in on a meeting with his team, to say he didn't have a college education in business, mm-hmm. He runs a drop zone like he's a CEO.
Yeah.
It's very impressive.
I know. And I think the one thing Steve and I often say about him, like we've been there for a long time. We've seen him run a drop zone. We've seen the drop zone do well. We've seen it not. We've seen, you know, good things and bad things happen. And I don't think I've ever seen him run or yell or, you know, get upset. You know, it just, he's just, yeah, incredible. Yeah. And what an amazing flyer and person. Just, yeah, yeah, really, really great. Yeah. And a competitor. Yeah. And even now, a dad, you know, and I think as our lives have, Steve and I, you know, the last few years have kind of changed us a bit. He also, I think, would say he's changed a bit in a lot of those ways. Just really cool.
When you planned for the team in 2007, I mean, still going today, mm-hmm. 2024,
yeah.
Could you have imagined,
yeah,
it was that in the cards that this thing would be an institution?
Yeah. I mean, of course, like I always like to, Steve always is like, Jeanette likes to think big and I'm always like, I don't know if I could do a 20. We'll see if we can get there, you know? So, but honestly, like it was just each year was like, I want to do something bigger. I want to, you know, give back to the sport more. I want to see how far I can get, where it's gotten to now. Man, I'm just so proud of where it is. And I'm proud of the impact that Steve and I have had, but then, you know, Doug and Andrew and all of the teammates, Christy, and the impact that the team has and the team now, it's great to see it continue on and the name. I feel very, very fortunate and very grateful. Yeah.
It's very cool. So let's talk about the team.
Yes.
2009, In open class, you placed sixth.
Yeah.
2010, fifth.
Yeah.
Fourth in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing progress.
Yes, I remember that.
And then runner-up
mm-hmm.
in 2012.
Yeah.
13.
Yeah.
14. 15.
Yeah, yeah.
16. 17. 18.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 consecutive years of coming in second.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you deal? You're right there. You're tasting the highest podium.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Like a lot of people say, look, if you're not winning, why wouldn't you go? And yes, but also if something's really easy and comes to you right away, then it doesn't really mean as much, you know? And I had a lot of time to gain experience and maybe wisdom in those years and realize that like the harder something is, the sweeter it'll be when you get there, you know? And also like, I mean, a lot of the guys that have been in it forever, you know, Dan BC and Kirk, and they all talk about how it's really the journey, you know? Eliana, I remember saying that to me very early on, like just enjoy the journey. In some ways, if I got to have a longer journey, like, well, that's kind of cool, you know? So it's interesting because the first year, that year that we came in fourth, I remember that year so well because that was the first year we showed up at Nationals and we were actually in the running. Like everything you're up until there was just like, okay, we're doing better. It was all about us. But there we actually were competitive. And we started round one. After round one, we were in second place. And then, man, the nerves were crazy for us. And Fury was there and the Golden Knights were there. And they slowly, the Knights quickly took over. And then Fury ended up beating us in round 10 and we came in fourth place. And I remember that so well. It was like such a formative, you know, like all those experiences, you know. So then the next year we came in second, but there was no Fury and we expected to beat the Knights. So it's kind of interesting that like each year, we also didn't expect to beat Airspeed that year. So we were just happy to be second, but it wasn't like, oh, we thought we would beat Airspeed this year, you know? So each year had its own flavor to it, you know, and we'd show up at Nationals many years and we knew where we'd be. So many years were like that. We knew, we were either rebuilding or, you know, we had a personal goal. And of course you want to win, but if you see, you know, you see what teams are doing and you know what you're doing and you kind of get there and expect to get there. So a lot of the, for me, a lot of the, I guess, what some might call like frustration about like constantly working and only being in second would come from, you know, maybe rebuilding or just the stuff along the way. But then also it was all journey too. And when I reminded myself about that, it was fine. It really wasn't until I think 2016, 2017 was when we were really like, okay, we feel like we could be there. And now we want to, not that we didn't want to win before, but it actually feels like something we could do, you know, to me.
I have to ask, in that span of placing runner-up between 2012 and 18.
Yeah.
You're runner-up to Arizona Airspeed.
Yeah.
Now, during this time, some of your teammates, Tiago and Mikhail, who are with Rhythm XP, SDC Rhythm mm-hmm. XP, end up leaving the team and joining Airspeed and then beating you.
Yeah.
Was that a tough pill to swallow going, ugh?
It is tough. But so it's emotionally tough because you know you've worked so hard for something and then them taking someone does two things. It allows them to get someone and then it hurts you as well. So it makes the gap even bigger. And I know a lot of people would be very frustrated and like, oh, you got to make people, you know, sign a contract or something. But I mean, I wouldn't want someone to stay because they were somehow legally or felt obligated to stay. I want somebody to stay because they want to stay, you know, because they think what we're offering is more them, you know, and they're, you know, we're a team and I want to be part of this team instead of part of this team. I remember in 2017, We were as close as we had ever been to Airspeed. And we were in the first day, we were kind of neck and neck, one point here, one point there. By the end of the second day, they were enough ahead of us that we didn't think we would win, but it was the first time I really felt like absolutely we could do this. And I remember at the end of that, having a conversation with the team and all of us saying like, man, you know, we really wanted to win, but I wouldn't want to be on any other team than this team right here, you know? And that's how I want my teammates to feel, you know? And so I think that's something that Rhythm had to figure out and grow into. And yes, our teammates left, but then also we had a lot of teammates that have been called by Airspeed. Pretty much every one of my male teammates has been called by Airspeed at this point. And many of them have said no. So to me, and I don't see that as like, I don't mean that as derogatory towards them. I mean, I see that as like, that's us as Rhythm figuring out how to make what we're offering different. If the only reason why you're staying is because you want to be on the best team, well, then of course, if the best team calls, you're going to go to them. So we need to find some way that makes you want to stay with us, that you want to be part of this group.
I suppose it's the ultimate compliment, you know, in the field of competitors, if the first one are going to Rhythm. And part of that is because of the team dynamics, the team structure, the culture that you all are building, mm-hmm. the discipline, the jump mm-hmm. numbers. It's, mm-hmm. it would seem like that would be where I would begin mm-hmm. if mm-hmm. I'm meeting new teammates for Airspeed. But I imagine it was character building to go through that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's also part of it. You know, I think it's part of any sport. And I certainly don't blame my teammates who left or Airspeed at all for it. I think it's the way it is, you know. And in fact, you know, Doug and Andrew, who were amazing teammates, they were on an incredible team. And when we asked them too, you know, and I know that was very hard for them and hard for all the people involved too.
I was involved in that because I was at Skydive Carolina and remember there, I think I had just left, but I was still very connected to Danny Smith, the DZO. And, you know, we've been with the guys since they were the Virginia Tech Space Dockers.
Yeah.
You know, so, but at the same time, we were so happy for them. We knew that it was the next level.
Yeah.
But then they get that full support. But we talked about the runner-ups between 2012, 2018. Perhaps the greatest nationals in the history of the nationals got to be up there. Happened in 2019, and you all are victorious. And what had to feel like through, you know, the 2000 teens, we're like, oh, we're so close, we're going to get there. And then 2019 happens. I've imagined like, well, you know, we'll just do our best.
Yeah. I mean, so there had been a lot that had happened prior to that. You know, the 2017 Nationals happened and we were so close. And I feel like that was the first time in a lot of ways. Like each of us, I think, you know, I know for myself, I actually finally believed I could do it. And so we were all just like, let's do it. And we were training. We were like, let's do it. We're going to train a ton. Everything's open. We're doing as much as we can. And then Doug had his accident in April. I remember the dive had an 11 in it. And then I remember watching. It's funny how you remember little things about that. And so after Doug's accident, we regrouped as a team and we were like, okay, what do we even do, you know, here? We had been the team, Doug and Andrew had been with us for 3 years already. And so we knew that like the time that Doug would need to get better and get back to the level we were at, as much as we loved each other and we loved being on a team together, there's a few people in the sport that'll do this their whole life, but not a whole team, you know, people come and go. And so we realized like, we really need to give ourselves rest, give ourselves time to do other things so that when Doug is better, the four of us are still meshing and ready to go, you know? So I think 2017, 2018 was a lot about that. It was 2018. We got hurt in 2018. That year, we got a fill-in. Steve and I and Andrew joined an eight-way team. We went on vacations. We also, at that point, that was when Steve and I decided, well, I guess we'll have a kid now. It'll be perfect. I'll get pregnant and I'll have a kid and I'll be recovering the same time as Doug and we'll get back to it. You know, that was the idea. We just had a lot of other stuff going on, I guess, is the short version of that. So then when we finally got back to 2019, Doug getting better, we were like, okay, we're going to get Doug better. And our goal was, let's just get back to where we were before the accident. That was it. It was very, very internal goal. And I know that's always the way you're supposed to go. And that's what we had thought we had done before, but it was the most real that could be for us. We were just like, all we want to do is get back to where we were before. So that was getting us training again, like we were before, us performing before, like we were before, all that stuff. And all summer, you know, we trained a little bit. We couldn't train as much as we wanted to. We were working with Doug's, you know, amazing recovery, but obviously you're not going to be able to train. I mean, he didn't start jumping until April before the Nationals, and we'd done some tunnel and stuff. And I mean, it felt good, but that was our goal. So then when we got to Nationals, before we got there, we were doing like a 22, and we knew we needed to be doing like a 25, 26. That was our goal, to get back to where we were. And when we got to Nationals that September, we did 20 jumps, and all of a sudden we were performing at that level that we were at. So I just remember we were just so, we just felt so happy and accomplished. Like we've done our goal. Our goal was to get back to where we were, and we are there. And we were just so excited to go do that at Nationals, and for us and for everybody involved, you know? So then you realize, well, that is actually good enough. Maybe. I mean, you also really don't, like, Airspeed had their own stuff going on and they had a lineup change. And so you really just don't know, but we knew that if we'd been doing a 22, we were probably not in the running. But maybe a 25, we don't know, and we'll find out, you know. So I think that's kind of how we were going into it. But it was the week before that we realized that, you know, for sure.
If you're a fan of the 20 Minute Call, I'd like to invite you to be a member of a budding community with me on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests and gain access to some show swag. It's pretty sweet. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. Okay, back to the show.
So you all get started, and
yeah,
this is something that that everyone recalls. I've spoken to Doug about this. I've spoken to Andrew, and I've spoken with Elliot.
Yeah,
and that there was something about the day.
Yeah,
it was like, it was a very high ceiling.
Yeah,
but it was almost, when I've heard each one, they all comment on that as if there was something different about this day. Just the way the sun was shining, there was something afoot.
Yeah, yeah. I think we were all just happy, you know, happy to be where we were, and with everything that had been through with Doug's stuff, and you know, and Steve and I had been through a rough year with, you know, we'd start trying to get pregnant, and we had had trouble, and we'd been working through that a lot. But when we got to Nationals, it kind of felt like, at least for me, it was like, okay, I'm putting just everything else aside, and I've now met this goal that I've been working towards. And so now I just get to enjoy it. And that day was kind of like the culmination of that, you know, like, there's all the other stuff I'm worrying about right now. I don't need to worry about it. All I got to do is just be with my team, that we've been through so much together, and here we are together. And you're right, that round one, I remember there was like that layer of like small, thin, wispy clouds. It doesn't get any better. Well, it does. The next day was even better. So they were great, both days. Yeah.
You know, so in the flow of competition, it's 10 mm-hmm. rounds. There's mm-hmm. an ebb and flow, and it goes yeah. across 2 days.
Yes.
And it seemed that you all were in flow.
Mm-hmm.
You were in flow state for both days,
yes,
where everybody except for your videographer is calm.
Yeah.
And I'm just teasing on Elliot, but I know he was super nervous when it went to jump off. But take me through your mentality of, okay, we're going to start the meet and just see how we do, to belief
mm-hmm.
we could do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that belief that we could do it and knowledge that we could do it, it was something that we already knew as a team. That 2017 Nationals that I talked about in Paris, like, I feel like for me, that was like the, oh, of course we could do it. And we've talked about it as a team, like, before you can win, you got to know you can win, you know? And so how do you do that? There was a Nationals at an indoor Nationals at Paraclete that we had won. So while it wasn't necessarily, we weren't like going in expecting it, when it was there, it was like, okay, well, we know what this is like, and we know how to do this, and I know we can do this, you know? And we knew each other well enough of how to like just work together as a team, you know, and how to, what to say and what not to say to each other to keep everybody going. You know, Steve and I have competed so many times together, and we know each other's differences, you know? So for me, round seven, I remember we had a really rough exit, and I think almost any videographer other than Elliot would have missed this exit. I mean, we got so flat, and he got it. And when you tie every point, it matters, you know? But anyway, I remember we came down, and I don't remember how many points, we only lost a few points. And to me, I was like, we only lost a few points on this round. Like, that's so encouraging. You know, I would never say that to Steve because that's not how he thinks in competition. You know, he would worry about it. But those little things, like, we just knew, yes, it wasn't what we expected, but once we were there, it felt very familiar. And this is a place we've been before. And so now let's just go do it. You know, we're ready to, and we knew each other, and yeah. And then that jump off round, man, you know, I pinch myself thinking about it. What an amazing thing.
Talk me through round 10.
Yeah.
If you would, you know, just being on the plane and it's down to the wire.
Yeah.
You and Airspeed.
Yeah.
The folks you've been runners up to since 2012.
Yeah.
This is it. It's all on the line.
Yeah.
Pretend as if I were on the plane with you in round 10. What did that look like?
Yeah. I mean, so going into round 10, I think we were up 1 point. And with every round, you land and like, so for me, it's like, okay, I know that was a good round. Great. And then without getting too technical into four-way, like there's often a couple blocks and then there might be a few randoms in between. So if you get to the beginning and then there's like two randoms right after that, it's a little bit nerve-wracking for me because I feel like, man, the other team might feel like they did well. And if they just get through those, you could easily get through those two randoms or not. And there's 2 points right there, you know? So if I land and I'm like, I did really good. And when I see the score, it's at the top of a block. I realize, okay, for another team to get another point on me, they have to get all the way through that block. And it's a lot more time. And then they really, I couldn't do that. So anyway, I land from round 10 and we had done really well, but we had gotten to the bottom of a block with, I think it was two randoms. And I don't remember, it must've been two. Anyway, some points after that. So I was like, oh, like, this is where the nerves come in. I'm like, man, I know we did really well, but they could get 2 points on us easily. You know, like, I know how they would do it. And they did. So we ended with round 10 and they had tied it up. Yeah. I kind of feel like the landing from that, maybe not, it wasn't as nervous as waiting, but it was nerve wracking for sure. And then we had the jump off. When I think about it and when I recount it, it's a moment I will remember my whole life. I mean, you know, like any kid who plays any sport just, you know, dreams of being like bottom of the ninth, bases loaded, you know, two outs, three balls. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, this is the moment that you just dream of being in a jump off with Arizona Airspeed to be, you know, the U.S. team. Also, you know, we knew Andrew and Steve were on the 8-way team. We knew that they would likely win and they would want to train. There'd be some decisions made if we weren't the team going to nationals. Would we want to go another 2 or 3 years? You know, so we knew all that was on the line. But just to be there in that moment and get to do that jump off was like, I mean, it's the stuff dreams are made of, you know? It just, And so, yeah, and we got to go do that with this group of people that, you know, they're like my best friends, it's, you know, and just, it was awesome. And I remember sitting there and the whole drop zone was just watching, you know, and we were sitting on the plane waiting and it was just us and them and boarding the plane and just the whole thing is something I'll smile about forever. It's awesome.
I'm ear to ear. And I don't know that there was a greater celebration.
Yeah.
You know, when the scores are released, you're really at your second home DZ. You all spent so much time at Paraclete. Mm-hmm. It was David versus Goliath. Maybe not in your minds, but in a lot of folks who have observed this runner-up
for
7 consecutive years.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was bedlam. The drop zone just melted for you guys. I mean, it was, everyone was so excited.
Yeah, it was, yes. What an amazing moment. Really, really cool. Really cool. And I got to be there. It was really cool. And so when you ask that question of like, how did it feel for 7 years to be in second? It's like, yeah, it hurts. But then like, man, it wouldn't have been like that. You know, like it wouldn't have been like that. You know what I mean? Lots of things. Like, of course, I would never want Doug to have his accident, but it wouldn't have been like that. You know, and then Steve and I had a lot of our own troubles with having a kid and I wouldn't want to go through that again, but like, man, you know, all those things had to happen in order for that moment, for me to be in that moment, you know, and it was amazing.
What a sweet moment. It was, I think the entire world of skydiving was happy for you all.
Yeah.
It was really cool. Yeah. Let's pivot over to 2020, which was a very challenging year for you.
Yes.
You know, health-wise.
Yes.
Here's all I recall. I remember seeing a video of you sharing mm-hmm. that, and I don't even want to try and pretend what the diagnosis is, so I'll have you tell us.
Yeah.
Also while being pregnant.
Yes.
Do you mind recalling that period of time?
No, I don't at all. So I was pregnant. That in itself is its own journey. I went through multiple rounds of IVF, multiple IVF transfers, multiple miscarriages. And I was finally pregnant, and we were just like happy, but also like, oh my gosh, you know, I kind of in disbelief still, you know. I was still working, and so I wasn't really telling a lot of people I was pregnant because I was still working. I knew Paraclete would be fine, but I was doing a little bit of work in Chicago, and I knew that drop zones that didn't know me, I mean, or tunnels or whatever, could easily say, no way, you're not flying while you're pregnant. So I was a little bit quiet about that. And I just wanted to work until I felt like I was okay to stop on my own terms, you know? So I was doing that. And I remember I was working a tunnel camp, and I was not feeling great, but I just figured it was the pregnancy. I remember I was working at a tunnel camp, and we were doing 2-on-2, and I was getting spun around on a block, and I just all of a sudden did not feel good at all. And I got out, and I was sick. Steve didn't see me get sick. And I remember he turned around and he was like, whoa, what's going on? And, again, I just thought it was like the pregnancy. So we went home, the week went on, and I was like, okay, I think that I'm done working tunnel. You know, I think that I was like, oh, this is my sign. I'm done working tunnel. And then there was a day I just didn't feel that great. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to lay down. And I went to lay down, and then this thing happened, which I'm sure at that point was a brain hemorrhage. I was immediately very dizzy and sick. I ran to the bathroom. I don't know how I got to the bathroom, but then I couldn't get up. Like, I couldn't even sit up. My balance was so bad. My vision, I had what's called nystagmus. So my eyes were doing this. And so for me, everything looked like it was spinning. I immediately was like, oh no, there's something wrong with the pregnancy. And I really, you know, it's just the worst things are going through your mind. You know, I was 27 weeks pregnant that day. It was April 1st, 2021. And Steve drove me to the OB, you know, and they were like, yeah, we'll come see you and figure out what's going on. And I remember, like, I couldn't even walk in. He had to like carry me into the OB. And then as soon as I walked in, a bunch of people came, but I couldn't see anybody. I didn't know. I just knew there were people there, and they immediately were like, no, you're going to the hospital right now. Like, we're not even going to see you. But they were so nice and as calming as they could be. And they immediately got a Doppler on me so they could hear Sage's heartbeat. And they were like, the baby's fine. Her heartbeat's fine. So that was like, you know, just very calming. So they took me to the hospital. And at the hospital too, they were like, it's probably just vertigo. We don't, you know, like it was just like, you know, we're going to do some routine tests. And they gave me a CT scan. And then the CT scan came back that I had bled in my cerebellum, which is, so like there's your brain, and the cerebellum is this little part in the bottom that controls like your breathing and your swallowing and like stuff that's really important that you take for granted until it's not working. And so that's where my brain had bled. And so then they were like, well, we want to send you to a hospital that has higher level of care for both the baby and for brain stuff, because if you're going to need a brain surgery, but you're pregnant, like the brain surgery, you'd be on your belly. And then if you go into labor, that's not really great to be on your belly. If we have to do a C-section, you know, and so there was like all of this stuff. It was weird. I mean, I think like all the things that happen with any kind of trauma, like, you know, Steve and I were both like, so he can't work tomorrow, but could he work the next day? You know, like we were just like trying to even figure out what this all meant. You know, I think when I was in the helicopter to Orlando was when it kind of set in for me that like, this is serious, you know, like this is really serious. And so they sent me to the neuro ICU at Orlando Health, where I was monitored by the OB doctors at Winnie Palmer. And then the neurosurgeons and stuff at Orlando Health. And what they thought I had was called a cavernoma or a cavernous malformation. And it's just like you can get it from birth. It's like a malformation of capillaries. Just something didn't kind of develop right when you were a kid. And most people who have these, they never know. They never bleed. And then some people whose bleed, they don't exist there in the cerebellum. They might just be on the top, and it's very mild symptoms. A lot of people who have these will go years and they'll be like, I know something's wrong, and nobody believes them. And then finally they're like, yeah, you know, so it's, I think my case was very rare that it was so severe and in such a place that deep in your head and your brain is so dense right there that my bleed was on the higher end of how much blood there was, which maybe that had to do with the pregnancy. I don't know. And also it was so dense that it caused a lot of, you know, very obvious symptoms right away. People looked at me and they're like, there's something wrong with you right away. I remember at that point thinking, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to me at this point, but I felt very comfortable that I didn't have any regrets. Like I had done, you know, I'd quit and skydived when I wanted to. And I had done, you know what I mean? I was like, man, I don't look back and say, man, I wish I had done this. You know, I didn't know, you know, if I would be able to skydive again, you know, or if I'd be able to see again straight, you know, it was a scary time. And so fortunately, it kind of, like, they didn't know it was a cavernoma because they couldn't do all the tests because I was pregnant. So they were kind of managing that back and forth. Luckily, they monitored me for a few days and I didn't get worse. So they released me to my house. I was at home lying flat with either both eyes closed or one eye closed for about a month. Like, it was funny. My PT went from, like, you know, before this, I was running, I was working in the tunnel. And then I was just, after that, I was just trying to stand. Like my PT was literally standing in a corner and trying to balance, you know, and I couldn't do that for a few seconds. It was just, and I remember I would say, like, I can't, this is not acceptable. But what does that mean? Like, you know, there's, you know, what is it? You know, okay, great. You know, noted. I slowly got better. Yeah, I learned a lot. Like, it's interesting. I often think about how there was a time that I was at home and I didn't see anybody, so I wasn't in the world. And then I got to go out. Like, I was walking with a walker. I was very pregnant and I had an eye patch. And so, like, when I went out, it was very clear there was something wrong with me. Like, I don't know what, but, like, so I would clear, like, I would go into a restaurant and everybody would get up. They're like, the pregnant woman with an eye patch and a walker, like, wherever you want to go, you know? And then as I got better, it became less apparent that I had deficiencies. So then how people interacted with me within in the world was different too, you know? So that was an interesting experience that I got. But yeah, so that happened and I ended up having a C-section because they didn't want me to go into labor because of all the stuff going on in my head. It was kind of funny. Like, we often joke that, like, that part, you know, the birth part for Sage was kind of the easiest part of the whole thing. Like, getting pregnant was tough. Being pregnant was not fun either. And then she was here. And yeah. And also during that time, and my team, you know, when it happened, Steve was like, we were at this point, they were supposed to go to the world meet in Russia. And it was too late to send to do an alternate, you know? So Steve was just like, I can't go to Russia. Like, you're having a baby, you had a brain hemorrhage. Like, this is crazy. I'm not going. But he did. We were all just like, you got to go. And the team was just like, whatever you need. It was just amazing that he got to go do that, you know? And then she was here. And then a year later, so at that point, what we decided was that they would just monitor me. I got a bunch of different opinions from different neurosurgeons. Many said they could operate. The one that I ended up going with at Johns Hopkins, she was like, you know what? It's deep in your brain and it's not going to make you better, but you could do damage going in there. And I would wait and see, because sometimes these things never bleed again. And sometimes they do. And if it does bleed again, then yes, we should talk about it. So that was our plan. And so that's what we went through. And I got better. I was walking again. I was driving again. I did a tandem. Andrew took me on a tandem. I started working in the tunnel again. And we were planning on going to Iceland that summer in 2022. And so before we went, I talked to my neurosurgeon. She's like, well, just get an MRI before you go, just to make sure. And I did. And I was already kind of not feeling great. But, you know, it was just like, okay, we're just, I just thought it was general life stuff. It's kind of weird when they tell you, like, you want to watch in case this bleeds again, but also, like, you're trying to live your life like, you know, like it's okay and you know it's there. But that MRI showed that it had blood again. And so I needed to have a brain surgery. So we had to cancel our Iceland trip. But that meant that I mean, my calendar was open and I remember talking to the surgeon and she's like, well, look and see when you could possibly do this brain surgery. It should be soon. And I'm like, well, whenever you want to, because everything is open.
I want to pop in here, Jeanette. I'm trying to empathize emotionally.
Yeah.
With just having had a child.
Yeah.
Now facing brain surgery without anyone saying conclusively, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine where you were mentally and emotionally, you and Steve. That must have been extremely scary.
It was. It was the second time. It was interesting. The first time was very much like a lot of unknowns and like, is Sage going to be okay? But she was with me the whole time. That was very comforting, you know? And then the second time it was like, I've had a year to like learn about these things. I know what recovery is like, you know, I knew all the stuff that I was kind of too naive to know. So it was scary in a lot of those ways too. But I also knew that, man, I felt like I was in the best hand. I went to the director of vascular neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins to do my surgery. The support I had from my friends and skydivers, like a student of mine flew us up in a private jet and flew us back. Students of ours found us a place to stay, lent us a car. It was just amazing the support we had for that, you know, for that whole thing. So it was scary, but I guess I always thought that I didn't think at that point that I wasn't going to make it through the surgery at that point. I think the only time I had those unknown thoughts was when it first happened and I didn't know what was going on. You know, at that point I was like, well, I've done this, like this is just another thing, you know? And I was, the one thing that was good about it. So to add one detail was that the second bleed had actually the, blood had kind of found a pathway into like a fluid sac in your brain. So that did a few things. One, it gave me an additional complication that it was causing issues with that fluid sac. So that was a problem, but it also gave the neurosurgeon a pathway to go through that was already damaged stuff. That was big knowledge for me, you know, and I felt very confident and comfortable with her as well. So I think that kind of gave us that. But for sure, it definitely made things scary. But I think also it's made me a better parent too, you know. I think everybody who's a first-time parent, there's so much pressure on young parents and on women, and are you going to do this and are you going to do that? And by the time I had Sage, it was like, you know, I am here and she's here and she's alive. It really does not matter, you know, like all these little things. Like, you know, I am just happy to be here and we're healthy and alive. You know, I mean, it's, you know, so in some ways that made, I feel like that maybe made me a more relaxed parent than I would have been otherwise.
So you had the second surgery.
Yeah.
And
yeah, so
being that we're speaking, it seemed like it went well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually ended up having two surgeries. The first one was 10 hours long. I came to and they said, you know, the good news is the surgery went well. The bad news is your entire family has COVID. So nobody's here because they were all staying in a house together. And I remember Steve was coughing like in the prep room as I was getting ready, but he was just like, but you know, this can't be a thing. You know what I mean? And then I guess during the day, you know, so the surgery was 10 hours long. So my parents, Steve, Sage, his parents, they all slowly tested positive for COVID. And so then when I came out, they're like, we just hope you don't have it because that's going to cause a lot more complications. And I didn't get it. But so then I was by myself and then they did more MRIs. And then they came back to me and said, you know, when we did the surgery, we got the clump, the mass out, but there's some left and it's not attached, but it could reattach like the hormones and stuff. So the surgeon was like, I would like to look at it and decide if we're going to go do a second surgery. And at that point, I remember thinking like, I really want them to go do the second surgery. I cannot imagine being here and going through all this and going home and still living with this. So she came back the next day and she's like, I really believe I can do this. And I was like, let's do it, you know? So yeah, so it was 10 hours. And then I think the second surgery was like 6 hours or something like that.
What was the gap in time between the first and the second surgery?
3 days.
Wow. Very quick.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very quick. Yeah. And it was funny because the first surgery, I remember going into it and they were saying, expect your symptoms to be like the first bleed. So when I came out of the first surgery, I had a lot of pain. You know, they expected a lot of pain because they went through the back of my head here. And there was a lot of like dehydration and all this stuff. But I didn't have any of the vision and neurological symptoms that I expected. So I was like, oh, this is great. And then when they did the second surgery, I did. I came to and all of a sudden, you know, my vision was bad. And I was like, yeah, this is... And that's what she prepped me for. The entire side of my left face, I had no control over. So like if I drank, anything would come out. My eyes were different ways. And poor Steve, his birthday was right in between. Yeah. Ugh. Not a fun time. So then when I came to, then I was, there were, by that point, like my family had found, you know, aunts and wives of friends and stuff to come be with me because all my immediate family was sick with COVID. And then I stayed in the hospital a little bit longer because there was nowhere for me to go, you know, and Steve was like, I'm not going to go visit her, not just until I'm kind of okay by current standards, but until like the test says zero COVID, you know, it's like, there's no way I want to do that. But I got better. And then we went home and I recovered at home. I went to physical therapy and occupational therapy. And yeah, now I'm at a point where I feel like I'm okay being like this, you know, and I think I'll keep getting better.
But let me ask you, Jeanette, you say like this, like what?
Yeah. 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 So that's the thing. A lot of people look at me and they have no idea that there's anything wrong with me, but I can tell like my vision is not the same at all. The part that's the worst is like your eyes are in two different spots. And so your eyes are seeing different things, but your brain kind of just figures it out and you see one thing. And when you turn your head, you see one thing, but that's what's damaged in my brain. So any little movement like this it causes issues for me. You know, that sensation you get when you're sitting on the train and like the train starts moving and I guess that's the best way I can explain it, but it's like all the time. So what does that mean for me? Being in big crowds, I can do it, but I get very tired quickly. Having stuff going on in this area is tough. Moving my head is tough, but I can drive, I can run, I can go in the tunnel. Like actually jumping and tunneling is fine. The like being in a boogie or organizing, that I can't do. So for me right now, it's just figuring out what does that mean? You know, how does that mean for my life and what am I doing? And
so you clearly don't, I would imagine I'd feel very nauseous.
So the first time I was very nauseous. I actually lost in my third trimester of pregnancy, I lost 15 pounds. I was the day I gave birth to Sage, I weighed less than I have since, you know, I mean, it just, but the second time I had all these symptoms, but I didn't have the nausea. I don't know if my brain just is like, okay, I've done this before, but I know how to separate these two. But yeah, I didn't have the nausea and I don't now. I just get, it's very tiring for me. And I notice now if I can get consistent sleep every night, I do so much better. My brain does so much better. I mean, I'm sure that was the case before, but it's very obvious for me now.
How do you get consistent sleep with a 2-year-old?
That's a good question. Steve is amazing. I can't imagine being able to do what I'm doing without him. He's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Whew, Jeanette, I feel like I haven't lived it, but.
Yeah.
You know, just thinking through what you've been through, it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I also think it's probably just a hyper version of what a lot of people go through when they quit competing at a high level, you know, and, or when they get older and have to start to, you know, I think a lot of my challenges now are I want to do a bunch of things, but I can't do as much as I could and trying to figure out how to prioritize my life and, you know, I'm very fortunate that I have more things that I want to do than I can do, you know, so that's a good place to be in. But what does skydiving mean for me if I'm not competing at the highest level, you know, which I can't do for multiple reasons now, but it doesn't really matter. You know, I think a lot of people go through that when they leave competition, you know.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people of Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing.
So you're not even saying that you're done with skydiving.
No, actually, I'm on a team for nationals this year.
Of course you are.
Yeah, it's amazing. So Steve, again, like, there is no way I would be able to skydive right now if it weren't for Steve. And I say that because, not because I can, like, I can skydive, but there's just so many things that I'm trying to get done, just sleeping enough and raising a two-year-old, and there's no way I would be able to skydive as well. Also, you know, all of my skydiving now is about running a team and coaching, and that part of it is still very hard and very tiring for me. Luckily, I'm in a place in my life that I can put that on hold, and I can raise a two-year-old and stuff like that. But so anyway, this team, there's me and Christy Fricken and Steve are going to be on a team with another guy. So this is great because Steve can do the work of organizing the team. I can focus on me and show up and jump. We're not doing a ton of training, but we're doing some. It's a perfect situation. And
I don't know who that fourth guy is, but he hit the lottery. He hit the four-way lottery right there.
Yeah. Yeah. He's awesome. But anyway, so yeah. And that whole thing wouldn't have happened if, you know, Steve is the one that's driving that and making that happen. And I just, yeah. It's amazing. So I need to start. I've done one jump on my own, and I need to get back to jumping on my own and figuring out how that's going to work. And it's nice that Nationals at Skydive Chicago this year, I feel like I've learned how to navigate the world in a way that I can manage. And at Skydive Chicago, I know exactly, like, okay, I can be here and not spend time here. I can go. So I'm just excited about it, and it's going to be great. Yeah.
I'm excited for you. I'll be watching this year's Nationals with a little bit more attentiveness than I plan to.
Yeah.
You and Steve have been mentors to so many jumpers.
Yeah.
Who are your mentors?
Oh, man. Well, I think Steve is my biggest influence for sure. But also within skydiving, I mean, of course, Cromie at the beginning, like, he was very much like all in for just, okay, if you guys want to do this, just work hard. Train hard, no excuses. He was huge. I mean, when you look at like people like Kirk Verner and Craig Gerard and Dan BC, who are just incredible people in the sport, and that they're doing this and they continue doing this, and BK, I mean, all of those guys, and then people I've gotten to work with, Shannon Pilcher has been such an incredible influence. Yeah, I mean, I got to work with Solly when I was on the Golden Knights. That was incredible.
I hadn't mentioned you're an honorary Golden Knight.
Yes. What yes. That was such a great, that was such a great year too. What an incredible experience that I got to do. What I got to go be train with the Golden Knights women and then go to the world meet with them. And then we won the world meet, and then I became an honorary Golden Knight. Like, what a special thing.
What a journey.
That was great. Yeah. Yeah. And also, if you know, Steve took all my work that summer so that I could go do that, you know? So it just, yeah, there's so many things that just wouldn't be if we didn't have each other, you know? Specifically, if I didn't have him.
It's very clear that Steve is an amazing human being.
Yeah. Yeah. He's awesome.
As you reflect on your career to this point,
yeah,
is there a moment in this journey when you think back about it, it lights you up going, that was cool.
You know, it's repetitive, but the whole 2019 Nationals, but that round 11 is just, you know, it's the stuff of dreams. Like, I will remember that forever. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think the year with the Golden Knights women was incredible. One moment that isn't competition related, but my mom did a tandem, and I'll remember that really fondly. She did a tandem. Steve was actually the tandem instructor, and I went with her, and yeah. It was just, yeah, I'll think about that a lot too. Yeah.
What an incredible career. And I'll tell you what came to my head when you said some of your students put you on a charter flight or a private plane and found you a place. You reap what you sow, Jeanette.
Yeah. Well,
you know, when we came onto the call, I recalled to you when I first met you and Steve, and I embarrassed myself, or at least I felt rather embarrassed because I was gushing. Mm-hmm. Seeing you all at Eloy during the Nationals, because I respected you all so much with how you treat people. It's always with so much respect and with humor. I've observed you all being very, actually very hilarious, but also operating at it's just the highest standard of professionalism. Mm-hmm. Like, it is refreshing to see. It's good to know that there is excellence personified mm-hmm. in what you all have done. So none of what I'm saying is with any hyperbole. Just no. I think myself and so many others are appreciative of how you all operate.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, to me, it just means so much, you know? Yeah. I listened to your interview with Doug, and he said some nice things about Steve and I too. And I just thought like that means so much. It means so much more than any moment or thing, you know, like in that. And actually those are the things that make the moments that you just asked me to recount mean so much, you know?
Jenna, thank you for your time. I have loved this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, I'm enjoying listening through your podcast too. It's great. Keep it up.
Thank you.
Hey everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20 Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Znydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us next week for our next episode.